Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Obamacare back in the courts. And Richard, last weekend, people all over the country woke up to some probably surprising news out of a federal court in Texas. Surprising insofar as I don't know how much of the public knew that the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, was being litigated again in the courts. And then they awoke to hear that a district court in Texas ruled in favor of a claim brought by some 20 state attorneys general and ruled that the entirety of Obamacare is unconstitutional. So why don't you start by explaining for us the case that these state AGs were making?
Yeah, this is really quite extraordinary. Well, what happens is the original statute has its centerpiece, the individual mandate, which was its most controversial feature. And what the mandate required quite simply was that if you as an individual who's not enrolled in either Medicare or some other kind of health plan service decide that you wish to decline services, you're not committing your fair share to subsidizing the older people who are inside the system. So we're going to charge you an exit tax. That's called the individual mandate, which you have to pay. When the thing goes up to the Supreme Court, everybody thought that the bill without the mandate would have been unquestionably constitutional under the Receive Commerce Clause jurisprudence, which has been around now for about 75 years, most notably in a case called Wickard and Filburn, where it seems to be that any time you're engaged in an activity that touches upon any form of commerce whatsoever or any form of trade, the federal government can regulate you. And what happened is, amongst other people, my ingenious friend, Randy Barnett, a professor at the Georgetown Law School, came up with the argument that once you put the individual mandate in, then the statute is unconstitutional for the following reason. In order to regulate commerce, there has to be an activity in commerce. And then going back to a lot of medieval stuff, you decide that nonfeasance, that is not doing something, does not count as an activity. So the federal government does not have the power to force you to enter into commerce so that they could have the privilege for regulating you. And at the time the thing came out, many people just scoffed at the argument. The most learned of constitutional scholars, Nancy Pelosi, just asked the question, why would anybody even raise this issue? We thought the constitutional question was a foregone conclusion. But it keeps gaining some odd form of momentum. And by the time it reaches the Supreme Court, what happens is there are two camps, one who believes this is a deadly serious challenge, and the other side who thinks it's the most ridiculous argument that they've ever heard. And it turns out that the swing justice in this case was none other than the Chief Justice John Roberts, and he takes the argument extraordinarily seriously. And he says, indeed, as I look at this particular statute, you do not have the power to do this. He then says, A, since it is clearly essential to what's going on, you might even have to think about severing it. This would be the issue that comes up. But he never gets there. Because what he then does is he says, aha, but if I look at this thing, I can call it a tax. And this, of course, also generated a lot of guffaws because seven or eight courts down below had said, if you pass this thing as a penalty, you cannot resurrect it as a tax. But in the Supreme Court, that particular binding condition wasn't there. And so what happens is Justice Roberts, in an opinion that basically has stunned a large number of people, upholds the statute under the taxing power, drawing the ire of the four conservatives and showing the four liberals that, look, you've got this unaccounted for blessing. Just take your money and run. Don't ask too many other questions. Write your opinion on the Commerce Clause, sustaining it on both grounds, but finish it that way. So there the matter sits. Now, what happens is the mandate was always a bust. It turned out they set it too low. It turned out they started creating all sorts of exemptions for it based on hardship and everything else. It turned out that the program seemed to run as well or as badly as you would expect with or without the mandate. And last year or so, what happens is in the Jobs Act that was passed, there was a section devoted to repealing the mandate. Judge O'Connor in the Texas District Court comes forward and says, aha, gotcha. It turned out that Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, had announced that the mandate was essential for the operation of the program. It turns out that it could only have been sustained under the commerce, rather under the taxing power. The taxing power is now explicitly withdrawn, so therefore it is explained, you know, justified by nothing. And if it falls, it takes the entire statute down with it. So therefore, ladies and gentlemen, we do not have an Obamacare statute at all. Now that we are only 8 years into the program, 6 years after it was upheld, and then some, we now find out that this small modification that was taking place last year is fatal to the continuation of the statute. I'm not going to tell you what the reaction was, but essentially there were a large number of people in the United States that went ballistic.
Okay, so as you mentioned, this turns largely, this ruling, on an issue that many of our listeners may remember from our earlier discussions about the ACA years ago, and that's this concept of severability. That is, when and whether striking down part of a law requires striking down the entirety of the law, which the judge is saying here. Can you give us a sense of the factors that usually determine the answer to that question for
yes,
judges?
Yes, I mean, look, essentially what happens is the more unrelated the item that you strike down is with respect to the items that you want to sustain, the more likely it is that the severability principle will be announced. In addition, there are many statutes which recognize that this is going to be a problem, and they often put in its severability provisions, which announce that if you strike out one particular portion of the statute, we want you to understand that it is the intent and desirability of Congress that everything else remain intact exactly as it was. And then what happens is that's not a trump. There are no trumps in this business. Somebody says, well, if it absolutely went to the core of the very, very statute, maybe that particular provision wouldn't apply. And the argument against applying it is that if you strike out absolutely essential features of the overall statute, what happens is it's no longer the same statute that it was. Now, when people say they're striking down the ACA, what are they thinking about is actually a serious ambiguity. Are they thinking about simply the individual mandate and the private plans that people get? Are they throwing into that all the material having to do with the Medicare program and the question as to whether or not states are going to receive subsidies for Medicare? That seems to be severable. And just to make it even a little bit simpler, there's probably not one person in 1,000 that knows that the BPCIA is in fact part of the statute, and you don't even know what BPCIA stands for. And this means that you're a mature man. It stands for Biological Protection, Competition, and Innovation Act. And what happened is there was an elaborate compromise that was made in connection with the creation of generic biologics, which are very, very difficult to manufacture, which set up a sharing regime in which some information went over to companies so they could use it. Others were retained. Who got the information and how they controlled it was elaborately done. This was a compromise that took months, maybe years to work out. It's part of the ACA, and I think you could say fairly well that there's no reason why you want to sink a statute like this 7 years after it's put into place, when in fact there's absolutely no connection with anything else. So that's the way it goes. In the actual case, they didn't have to face the severability question because it turned out that they sustained the whole statute under the taxing power. Now what you have to consider it, he said, look, I'm tracking Chief Justice Roberts, and he said it was essential. And if it's essential, it goes, everything else goes. Do you like that argument? I'm asking you, Troy.
I'm just here to moderate, Richard. Let me ask you this. If you read the press on this, you'll find decidedly different opinions on where this case is going. There's a piece in the Washington Post just a couple days ago says this never gets past the Fifth Circuit, while at the same time there's a piece in the New York Times says this virtually guarantees it'll get before the Supreme Court. What's your view on that? Does this case have any plausible road to success?
Well, let me put it this way. If they decide in the Fifth Circuit to sustain this particular challenge, it is up on the Supreme Court automatically. But the odds of the Fifth Circuit sustaining this thing, even if it's a relatively conservative court, is, I think, very low. And to put it another way, if, in fact, this particular challenge is rejected and the statute's intact, the chances of the Republican attorney generals going to the Supreme Court and getting them to consider the case, I think, is very, very remote. So a lot of this depends upon which way the thing comes out. And I believe, I think pretty certainly, that this is such a confused opinion that the likelihood that it would be sustained by the Fifth Circuit is remote. What's going to happen is when it gets to the Fifth Circuit, it's not going to be just this kind of odd case tucked away in a corner. There are probably going to be all sorts of amicus briefs, learned articles, and so forth that are written about the subject. And once the people actually understand what the sort of intellectual gaffes are in this opinion, I think that the statute will be sustained, and it will be sustained for perfectly obvious reasons. Let me just sort of explain to you what I think is going on. If you go back and you look at the original statute, and you did not put in the original mandate, then everybody at the time agreed that this case is in fact governed by the Commerce Clause, and the statute's perfectly constitutional. So what happens is, if in fact you take out the mandate, it's not only that you don't have the taxing power to sustain it, you don't need the taxing power to sustain it because you can sustain it under the Commerce Clause. So think about it like this. Suppose what Congress had done, had kind of instantaneously repealed the whole statute and then reenacted that statute without the tax mandate put into it. At that particular point, the one objectionable feature as far as our peculiar Commerce Clause jurisprudence is about would disappear, and so the statute would be unconstitutionally be constitutionally unchallengeable. There'd be no way, at least under current law, that anybody on either side. The whole point about the Randy Barnett argument, and it's worth mentioning it, was extremely clever. What Randy was faced with was the following very serious challenge. Is you want to declare this statute unconstitutional for all sorts of reasons, none of which have anything to do with the Commerce Clause or the taxing power as such. You tend to think that this is massive government intrusion in an area where it's likely to fail. But if in fact what you do is you engage in a frontal assault and say, look, Wickard and Filburn is wrong, all of the other New Deal cases are wrong, this thing goes down because you have to overrule 75 years of precedent, you're going to be met with the following argument from somebody like the Chief Justice. Well, let's think of the statutes which are unconstitutional now we decided this case this way. And so, you know, you can start any way you want. Start with the Civil Rights Acts, for example. They all disappear from the books. Now, what's the likelihood that the United States Supreme Court is going to declare all the civil rights statutes in the United States on the books now for over 50 years unconstitutional because Wickard and Filburn goes down? This is not happening. Even people like myself who think it should happen as a matter of abstract principle understand perfectly well that the reliance interests are so great that you just can't completely unravel scheme after scheme after scheme under every conceivable statute with this. So once Randy understood that, he said, what I need to do is I can't use a hatchet on this statute. I got to find myself a laser beam. And so what you do is you try to develop an argument which allows you to declare this statute and only this statute and only this statute in this form unconstitutional and leave the rest of the modern New Deal, wealthful, social democratic state completely intact. And this nonfeasance, misfeasance line in which you said, look, the problem here is quite simply that you're not engaged in commerce and so therefore we can't force you to do it. That's the one argument that had a little bit of traction. Do I believe that argument? Not really. In my view, I think when you say that Congress has the comprehensive power to regulate all sorts of commerce, I think what you're meaning is that there are many programs that have duties. Some of them have prohibitions of one kind or another. And I think what you have to do is to look at the statute as an integrated whole. And to the extent you think that the statute regulates some form of economic activity, in this case about 1/7 or 1/6 of the entire economy, then you don't do it piece by piece, element by element. So my view about this was at the time that the Wickard and Filburn line was correct. But I liked the other argument a little bit. And I said, if you've got any doubt, this is what you should do, is you should say, we understand the importance of the reliance interest. So we're telling Congress we're not going to try to change anything, but we're not going to extend a very dubious doctrine any further. That is, the position I took is Wickard and Filburn was wrong from the day it was decided. You're not going to overturn it. But if you're not going to overturn it, you don't have to extend it. And then you could strike down the mandate. But even if you took that position, once the mandate disappears, you don't need the taxing powers. The fact that you don't have a power that you don't need doesn't mean a hell of a lot. It means quite clearly that the statute is modified as constitutional. Now, another way of looking at this is say, what is congressional intent about this? And here you have this huge statute, and then you get this couple of paragraphs out there, and you ask yourself, if you put the question before the Congress, now that you have repealed this individual mandate, which has been a pain in the neck for everybody, do you really mean to declare the entire Obamacare program unconstitutional? There would have been nobody on either side of the aisle who thought that that was the consequence of what went on. So if this is a matter in any way, shape, a form of congressional intention, it's going to come out the same way. The argument on the other side, the intention doesn't matter. It's whether or not it's constitutional that matters. And then that gets you back to the exact argument that we had before. In my view, the one sentence answer to the opinion that was done is he's absolutely right. The taxing power was what was needed to sustain the mandate. But once the tax disappears, then we could sustain this under the Commerce Clause.
Let me ask you a policy question. It has become clear, especially during the midterm elections, that Democrats think, and they're likely correct about this, that their most potent rhetorical tool against Republicans on health care is the protections for pre-existing conditions. They ran for office saying Republicans were going to take those away. They can now say that the effect of this lawsuit would be to take those away. So, Richard, just as an intellectual exercise, let's play out a scenario where this ruling stands and the entirety of the ACA is gone. Is there a path to a sensible policy for people who don't want a heavy government hand in healthcare, but still think that lawmakers should do something to address the pre-existing condition problem?
If there's one path, there are 50. And one of the reasons why the statute continues to hang on, notwithstanding the fact that there are many, many serious problems in its implementation, the scope of its coverage, its financial solvency, and so on, is that if you have 20 people who are healthcare experts, you have 20 different healthcare plans that you ought to replace it with. So one of the reasons why the Republicans grievously miscalculated on when they said what we're going to do in these particular circumstances is repeal the statute, and then we'll replace it with something else. But there'd be no statute that you could imagine that would have allowed this to have happened. So what should they have done? Well, I think they should have done a lot of things. The first thing you have to do is you have to take on the sacred cow. That is the no restrictions with respect to pre-existing conditions. It sounds awfully good if you're the person who has a pre-existing condition who would like to be covered. But remember, these plans are closed systems. And if you're giving a huge subsidy to one person or one small group of individuals, everybody else is going to have to pick up the pipe. It turns out that as these costs become heavier, with or without the mandate, there'll be massive exodus from these kinds of plans by people, particularly young people in their 20s, who say, why should I pay $8,000 for health care coverage when my annual expenses are going to be $158 a year? So they pull out. And there's no way in which you could lure them back in. Once they leave, then you have to raise the premiums even higher on everybody else within the system, and you get exactly what the Chief Justice describes as the adverse selection death spiral. Every time you raise the rates, people who find it on an economical leave, the pool that remains is even riskier. You have to raise the rates again until there's one person left who just pays for his own health care in advance. That's what it comes down to, and you can't make that kind of a system stick. The mandate was thought to solve it, but of course what happened is the moment they put it in there and they realized what it would cost, they knew it was a non-starter. You're not going to be able to tell, quite bluntly, a 26-year-old who's earning $33,000 a year that in order for him to stay out of this particular health care plan, what you have to do is to fork over $4,972 or huge portions of your income. It's just not going to work. So what they did is they kept it in form and then they systematically underfunded it. And even so, that meant that you now had even easier chance in leaving, which created further difficulties. So what you have to do is you have to actually look at the plan in order to reduce the cross subsidies so as to prevent the death spiral from taking place. Now, there are many ways to attack the pre-existing conditions situation. The current system is you come in whenever you want, you leave whenever you want, you get whatever coverage you need in the interim, so you pay 2 months of premiums and you get 2 years' worth of work. And it's a real art form. I've been told by some very learned people in the business that what happens is all the intermediate organizations come up there. So if you've got a child with diabetes, they will send you a notice. You now need to get some kind of health care coverage. This is the day for you to enroll. This is the day day for you to disenroll when you're all done, and you could take advantage. So it turns out the performance keeps getting worse and worse because people become more adept at playing the system. So what do you need to do? You actually have to make pre-existing conditions subject to conditions. What are those conditions? You can say, well, you know what? If you come in, we're going to let you come in, but you have to come in 30 days before you need any treatment, or more importantly, you have to stay for at least a year. And if you want to exit before a year, then you do have to pay a fairly stiff penalty. And even that simple kind of reform requiring them to stay is a reform which, when it's put into place, has the very desirable effect of reducing the size of the subsidy and therefore reducing the amount of opportunism that rides the system. And I think it's pretty hard for somebody to say when they've joined under these circumstances, gee, you know what, you've now required me to stay for a year and to pay $6,000 in order for me to get $16,000 worth of treatment. You'd obviously don't balance the books on this, but if you could reduce the deficit by some amount, that would help. Second thing that you have to do, you have to thin out the set of benefits that are being given under the program. The set of minimum essential benefits under Obamacare are so rich, it's like telling everybody you've got all sorts of choices in the market. You can go anywhere from a Mercedes-Benz up to a Rolls-Royce, but you can't do anything less. And what happens is people want to drive out because they're forcing them to take stuff that they really don't want to take. And if you put that together with the other stuff, you've got problems. And then what you have to do is you've got to find some other way to control the administrative drag and overhang in terms of the fees that can be charged and the oversight that's going to be given. So what you do is you go through the statute point after point and try to figure out, is there any way we can tweak it, which makes it look a little bit less regulatory and a little bit less market-oriented? And if you put four or five of these things together, it's going to make a huge difference. And so, for example, I worked for the Idaho Blue Cross earlier this year trying to figure out how they could get one of their special plans in. And this is what they told me, and I certainly believe it's true. They said, if you can modify the pre-existing conditions in the way that I've suggested, if you can change community rating, so it's not a 3-to-1 ratio, but a 5-to-1 ratio, that is, somebody who is essentially 25 takes only about 15% of the cost per annum as somebody 65, but now you're required to charge them 25%. Well, you do the math. And essentially what happens is when you change that ratio, 50% of the premium that this guy is paying, roughly speaking, is going to take care of other people. And that's just an unsustainable burden. And so what you have to do is to change that ratio. Maybe you don't go to 5-to-1. Maybe you go to 4-to-1. But there are a whole host of levers that if you pull them, could bring this thing back. The truth about the matter is all of the people who proposed this program, they were living in a dream world. They said one of two things, both of which were false. One of them is they said that people won't leave because they've got themselves a social conscience and therefore will be willing to subsidize some anonymous elder. Or they'll say these people will realize that their own health is so important that even though actuarially it doesn't check out, they're going to join the plans anyhow. Both of those naive assumptions turned out to be wrong, and that's the root of this problem. So they got to address it. I see no sentiment on the part of anybody to do this. The only sentiment you're having now with all the new rage on the socialist side is that we have a single-payer system, which would be a total catastrophe in terms of the way in which it operated. It would bankrupt anybody and everybody, because what it would do is it would take the worst features of Obamacare and give it to the entire population. And you can play a game where Group A has to subsidize Group B, but you can't play a game where everybody has to subsidize everybody, because then you're paying more than you get out of it, and you're all worse off in consequence of what happened.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at Hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.